Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. On September 9th, 2010, while he was embedded with a U.S. Army unit in a small village in eastern Afghanistan, journalist Carmen Gentile was struck in the face by a rocket-propelled grenade. Inexplicably, the grenade didn't explode, and Mr. Gentile survived, but the right side of his face was shattered, and he'd been blinded in his right eye. In Blindsided by the Taliban, a journalist's story of war, trauma, love, and loss, his book From Skyhorse, he chronicles his numerous missteps and shortcomings while coming to terms with a terrible injury and a personal life in shambles. New inventive surgeries ultimately saved Mr. Gentile's face and eyesight, but the depression and trauma that followed his physical and emotional injuries proved much harder to overcome. Ultimately, he would find that returning to the front lines and continuing the work he loved was the only way to become whole again. Carmen Gentile joins us now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
When did you begin reporting from Afghanistan?
I started going to Afghanistan in about 2005, and I was going there on and off through the years until I got hurt and had to take a little bit of a break after I was injured in the face, undergoing 4 surgeries, one to restore some of my vision and rebuild my face with the help of 12 titanium pins and 4 plates. And after 8 months of convalescing and figuring out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, I realized I wanted to go back, and that I did.
And we'll talk about that in the course of this conversation, but I'm curious about how you got there in the first place. How did the opportunity arise? Who were you working for at the time?
I was freelancing for a number of publications, and I had one editor ask me if I wanted to go. And at the time, I was based in Rio de Janeiro. I was covering Latin America, and I had always wanted to see what the situation was like on the ground in Afghanistan, and just my curiosity got the best of me, and so I decided that I would accept it and go.
Well, but you still have to arrange to be embedded with some troops. Is that an easy thing to do?
Well, at the time, they had a really well-organized embed process with the military, in that you would reach out to a public affairs officer somewhere, you know, on the ground in Afghanistan, and say, "Hey, this is the kind of story I want to do. This is the outlet for which I'm working. Can you accommodate me? These are the dates I would like to be there." And then you would go back and forth, and it worked out fairly well. From what I understand, this, you know, being a little bit before my time in the Vietnam War, it was more along the lines of, "Hey, this helicopter's taking off, and we're going here. Mm-hmm. There's free space; you could jump on and go." Sort of more informal, but over the years, that the process had been formalized and was, and it ran fairly well up until about the 2013, 2014, when the troops were drawing down in Afghanistan, and then that process wasn't as organized, and now it's more difficult to get those embeds.
What are some of the challenges facing U.S. troops fighting the Taliban? Why were the Taliban fighters so hard for our soldiers to see?
Well, the Taliban is not gracious enough to wear uniforms. they dress in plain clothes, and they can blend into the civilian population. They also have the strategic advantage through much of the fighting that's in the rural countryside, because they own the high ground. They don't have large combat outposts that they build up in these valleys and places where the U.S. forces are concentrated. They are more mobile and nimble, so this is their home turf, and they've lived there for thousands of years, and they know every boulder and stone and goat path and every nook and cranny of those mountains, and in ways that U.S. forces and other NATO forces were never able to replicate. So that's what made it very difficult.
And they're doing this on the border with Pakistan, so they can go back and forth. But
correct, they have that line of that demarcation line is one that they don't recognize, but that U.S. forces do. So they just can't run across the border to Pakistan and chase them down.
And what is life like for the U.S. troops who are fighting the Taliban in the mountains of Afghanistan? Do they have set bases?
Yes, they do. They had combat outposts and even smaller fire bases in the mountains, either on top of the mountains or in the valleys, where conditions could be really rough. Not a lot of hot meals, no running water. So staying clean was not even an option. They'd go weeks or months without a shower, and it was hard living for those guys.
And were the soldiers okay with having a reporter in their group? How willing were they to open up to you?
You know, for the most part, I've had really good experiences working with servicemen and women who've been accommodating to me. You know, sometimes they could be a little standoffish because they're such a close-knit community in these small combat outposts. They're, a handful of guys and sometimes a few women there as well. And they know each other and they depend upon each other for life and limb. And when an outsider comes in, it can be jarring. But then at the same time, they're so used to being around each other and having somebody else come around who's not a regular person in their lives can be a novelty. So they want to talk to you about things. And most of the times what we end up talking about is what have you been watching on TV? What's cool now? What's going on in the States? Do you get to watch any sports? I would say that most of the time I spent with soldiers and Marines, we probably talked about sports more than we talked about what was going on there. And that was the common thread that we had. Was being able to talk about things that took their minds away from what they were doing.
So what led you to become a journalist in the first place?
Oh, I just think I'm naturally borderline obnoxiously curious. I think I have this tendency to just want to know why, and I mostly want to figure it out for myself.
Did it begin in college?
I had interned at a newspaper in college for a couple of summers, and then I got away from it. I wasn't sure that's exactly what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to write, and I wanted to see the world, and I wanted writing to pay for it, but I didn't know how exactly. You know, I was a philosophy major with a minor in Islamic studies. It's not like people were beating down my door to give me a job. And I went and started my career in the late 90s in Cairo as a reporter just by chance, because I'd gone there to study Arabic at a school in Cairo, and I really liked it. I liked being overseas. I liked what I was experiencing my day-to-day, and I found a job. And I managed to, that's where I managed to start my career.
I've been told by other war correspondents that the adrenaline rush can be addictive. Is that one of the things that attracted you to being a war correspondent?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. It's. I'm not going to even try to pretend like that's not part of it. Yeah, of course it is. And I would say a key portion of my personality, for better or for worse, sometimes both.
You're right that you have a compulsion for risk, but you say there are two different types of risks.
Yeah, there's what I like to think of as the calculated risk. You assess whether or not something is a good idea. You plot it. You plan it. You know that there's a certain amount of danger involved, and what's the reward for said danger? And you would think that that's the mature, reasonable way in which to potentially do something that might cost you your life. You want to give it as much thought as you can. And then there's just the kill crazy cowboy risks that I call them.
And which
people take sometimes.
And which risks were involved on the day that you were hit by the RPG?
Right, rocket propelled grenade. I would like to think that it was a calculated risk, but if I, in retrospect, it was a little more of a cowboy risk because we were going into a village on the last day of Ramadan at sunset. The previous evening on an embed in which I did not go, soldiers had gone out in that exact same area and been hit by a rocket to one of their trucks, which had disabled it, and they had to tow it back to the combat outpost. And so in my mind, I thought, okay, I better go back. I better go on this next one because there had already been action there last night. I should see it. But the timing was just terrible. And as soon as we were in that village, I started getting that hinky vibe that something was wrong. And lo and behold, I was right.
But what is the significance of it being on the last day of Ramadan?
Well, the last day of Ramadan is after you have a prolonged period of fasting. The end of Ramadan marks the Eid, which is the three-day celebration where you have food and festivities and everyone's having a good time. And here we were in the last day. It's at sunset. They're just about to get ready for the end of Ramadan. And U.S. forces are walking through this tiny little village during one of the most sacred times of year. And, hindsight being 2020, that was a bad time to be doing that.
And as we said earlier, this is near the Pakistani border. Is that a particularly
Correct.
Dangerous area?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very mountainous. Very hard to navigate. The roads are very narrow and uneven, and just dirt roads along a rapidly moving river. And a lot of IEDs were in the road at that time. In fact, just a couple of days prior, one of the IEDs, an IED had been found in the road that had 100 pounds of explosives in it. And during a controlled detonation, it was set off by the explosive ordnance disposal unit that came in, like the guys from the Hurt Locker, and they blew this thing up and it made this enormous explosion, which I ended up catching on video.
Now, you were doing video, so you were both a print journalist and a video journalist. Who are you sending these
Correct.
Things to?
At that time, I was working for CBS, and I was also working for USA Today. So I was writing stories for USA Today, and I was doing radio primarily for CBS, although I had done some video work for them as well. And with much of my print reporting with USA Today, I would also do video pieces. So it would be part of a multimedia package, which is a lot more common today. So I was shooting this video while I was talking to people in this small village, and I knew something was wrong. And you could even hear on the video the nervousness and the tension in my voice,
because
I had my camera.
What was giving you the sense that something might be wrong?
Well, one of the key indications when you go into these situations is you have to look for the kids, and if there are kids milling about, playing, giving you the high five and wanting to talk to you with a few words of English that they know, then you have a good idea that maybe things are okay in a particular place. On this particular late afternoon in these mountains, at that time, all the kids were gone. There were no children around. And when the kids are not around, you know something is up. All you saw were men. They were not particularly friendly. They did not want to talk to us. And I had my video camera trained on a group of young men sitting by the side of the road. And while talking to them, I heard this loud whooshing sound. And I turn around while my camera's still on them, and you could see their eyes getting big, the rocket came screaming toward me from someone who is, 40 yards down the road, and it smacked me in the side of the head and just blinded me in my right eye.
Did you think for that split second that you were going to die?
I was absolutely certain I was going to die because I had that cringe-inducing moment of terror, and then it ended just as quickly. And melted into acceptance. I figure, well, okay, the lights are going to get turned out right now. Here's where it comes. And it was a sort of sedation in me that I felt that they say is a chemical that's released when you're being devoured by a predator that other animals have, so that the end is not so horrifying. And that's what it was for me. I was just, in a flash, resigned to the fact that I was going to die. And when that rocket hit me and it blinded me in my right eye and everything went black, I thought that was it. I thought that was the moment I died. I thought I died. And that the lights were going to go out of my consciousness any second.
I'm speaking...
But in fact...
Go ahead.
Yeah. But in fact, it didn't go off. And in a trillion to one chance that I'll never be able to explain, that's what happened to me.
I'm speaking with Carmen Gentile, spelled G-E-N-T-I-L-E. His book, Blindsided by the Taliban, A Journalist's Story of War, Trauma, Love, and Loss, is published by Skyhorse. And this is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York. Do you speak Pashtun? I guess that would have been the language of the people you were talking to at the time.
Oh, I know a few phrases here and there, but for the most part, I've depended upon translators.
What were the... Okay, we talked about the extent of your injuries, but... So there you are in the middle of nowhere. How did you wind up getting good medical treatment?
First and foremost, I got excellent care from the medic in the field. When the rocket hit me, you could even see in the video that I've posted, it's available on YouTube, you can see... you can hear the medic asking me, are you okay? Because my camera was still running. And although I had dropped it when I got hurt, and I said, yeah, I'm fine. And I did not say I was fine. I said, no, I got shot in the side of the head. I'm clearly not okay. But they gave me this really great treatment in that, they were able to wrap the wound and bandage it and staunch the bleeding because it was so bad. You know, head wounds bleed particularly profusely. And I, all the while, the rest of the soldiers in the platoon were taking defensive positions because often in that case, the Taliban likes to do a 1-2 punch where they seek to just injure somebody in the first attack so that the others have to come to that person's aid. And then while others are coming to that person's aid, that's when they come with a more robust secondary wave of the attack to wipe everyone out. So there was a lot of concern that there was going to be a follow-up attack right after that. And much to the credit of the soldiers in this platoon, they really took care of me and the platoon leader who was struck in the elbow. After the rocket hit me, it hit the platoon leader in the elbow, and he was injured as well. So there were two of us down on the ground. And it was then shortly thereafter that they called in for a medevac, and we were taken away. I was eventually taken to the U.S. military hospital at Bagram Airfield, which is the large military base in eastern Afghanistan. And I received excellent medical care there. There happened to be an Air Force ophthalmologist on staff at this hospital who my other doctors later said, managed to save my eye.
Did they think you were going to lose your eye at first?
Oh, when I woke up from my first operation in the hospital in Afghanistan, they told me, yeah, you're going to lose that eye. You're not going to keep it. And so I had to mentally start processing the idea of not having one of my eyes. And, I went through a lot of different feelings about it over that period, but didn't ultimately was able to keep it and have some of my vision restored, although I keep it covered with a patch most of the time because I have two separate fields of vision. My right eye is particularly blurry, and it's also sensitive to light and to wind and to particulate matter, so it's always very red and irritated, so I keep it covered a lot of the time.
I was wondering about that because many of the photographs I've seen of you are with the eye patch, and yet I've also seen you on television without the eye patch.
Right. My vanity gets the best of me when I don't want people to see me on TV wearing an eye patch. I've recently come to realize that I need to be more comfortable than vain. So I need to. So I wear it most of the time now. I don't wear it when I'm driving, in the event that I get pulled over, and I don't want an officer to see me wearing an eye patch I'm driving a car, so, or riding my motorcycle. So I wear sunglasses, and I, with sunglasses or any other tinted eyewear, I can. It's not as bad with the glare in my right eye, and the irritations. So it allows me to have vision in two eyes, while at the same time protecting the bad one.
How many surgeries have you had?
Four. I had a total of four. The first one I had in Afghanistan was just to repair the rupture in my eyeball. The eyeball itself was lacerated, and there's this jelly inside your eye that gives it that nice, plump, roundish shape. And it was all that jelly in my eye had come out and spilled into the side of my head. Not to get too graphic here, but they had to take that jelly, put it back in, and then stitch the side of the eyeball up. And after a certain amount of about a week and a half of healing, doctors were able to go back in and repair some of that work, and then do some of the work to repair the side of my face, which had been absolutely decimated. I looked at X-rays of my face from that time, and it looked like a box of loose toothpicks in there. Everything was just shredded, all the bones. So what they had to do was put a number of plates that run under my eye, up and through the underneath the eye, and it runs all the way to the side of the right of my eye, almost to the top of the where my eyebrow is, and use all these pins and plates to put everything back together. I still have all those that hardware in my face.
But they did a wonderful job because seeing you, one would never guess. It's
right.
Yeah, we have to be told. On the other hand, there's another kind of healing involved. How long before you were able to watch the video that you'd recorded that day? I'd imagine that that would have been a traumatic thing for quite a while.
I watched it in its entirety one time in my life, and I watched it about 6 months after it happened. The video, and this is chronicled in my book, so I don't want to give away too much, but there's a moment about 6 months after the incident happened, I finally was able to turn on that camera and, with the help of a friend who's an excellent video editor, go through it and look at it. And I remember sitting at his home and saying, I wasn't sure if I'd actually caught the incident on camera. And lo and behold, we were in his living room in Miami, going through all this material, and I could see where I was walking in that area, and I could hear the rocket, and I could see the rocket, the effects of the rocket hitting me in the side of the head, and then my camera dropping to the ground. So I heard the actual thwack of the rocket against the side of my head, and it was nerve-wracking, to say the least. And that was the only time I've ever seen it in its entirety. It's been online for years now.
Anyone can see it on YouTube?
To go back. Yeah.
But you're not seeing it again. Do you think you can? Or what's the reason that you would not want to watch it again? Because it would bring back all of those terrible memories?
I have a pretty vivid recollection of what it looks like in my head. I could tell you moment by moment what it did look like. It's always playing in my head. I don't need to watch it on video. I've got it. I've got it all upstairs.
How long before you could return to being a journalist?
Well, my doctors had me on medical leave. This happened in September, and they told me for 8 months I needed to just recover. So as of May 1st, I was cleared to start working again. And by the middle of that month, May 2011, I was back in Afghanistan.
It comes as a big surprise. You actually returned to this place where you'd had this terrible experience. So weren't you afraid?
Oh, terribly afraid.
I mean, you had been seriously injured.
I was petrified. After I was seriously injured, I went back. No one's ever going to nominate me for Mensa, that's for sure.
How did your family and friends feel about your desire to return to an active war zone?
Oh, they thought I'd lost my mind, and they weren't that far off the mark. I'd lost a little bit while I was recovering, but in my estimation, I felt like I couldn't let that incident define me for the rest of my life. And so I had to figure out a way to get past it. Now, I know for a fact that when my obituary is written, that's probably going to be in the first or second paragraph. No doubt about it.
What, that he went back after?
I wanted to be able to, I thought in my mind that it was the best for me to not let it define the rest of my life. I didn't want to get chased away. This is something I talk about in the book. Like, what am I going to do with my life? This is not something I want to have be such a definitive moment, in that it keeps me from doing something that I'm pretty good at doing and I love to do. So I kept telling myself that you can't let this moment discourage you. You have to go back and pull yourself up and do what you know how to do. Was it the right decision? I don't know. It seemed like the right one for me.
Did you notice yourself being more tentative than usual in terms of your movements and the things that you did?
Right. I was on pins and needles for the first. I went back for a really prolonged period of extensive number of in-beds for 4 months after I went back to Afghanistan that first time. I've since gone back about 7 times, but that first time I went back after being injured, I was panic stricken, just walking around the streets of Kabul, which at that time was relatively safe and free from any real hazards that I'd faced in rural Afghanistan. But I was just constantly looking over my shoulder, and you know, I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do it. In fact, I got off the plane and thought, "Ooh, this is a terrible mistake. I should not be here." And I, through just pure stubbornness, and managed to drag myself through the first few embeds while concealing my terror from the soldiers and Marines with whom I was embedded, because I don't want to worry them too much. And I made it through.
Well, you mentioned that you felt safe in Kabul, but there have been suicide bombings in Kabul over the years. And quite a few journalists have been killed in suicide bombings. A number of them have been kidnapped or otherwise targeted. Did you get the feeling that you were targeted in that village because you were filming and talking to the villagers?
You know, I think the rocket, I was standing among a group of soldiers, and I don't think that individual that fired it was particularly targeting me. One, because that ordnance is not that precise. It's not like a sniper rifle where you can beat in on one person and try to take them out. Those things have a lot of wiggle in their trajectory. So I think it was just dumb luck that it hit me in the side of the head, and that it had been fired from such close range and that it didn't have time to arm itself, or for whatever reason, maybe it was a dud. We'll never know why that thing didn't go off.
You even noticed the color, that it was a green RPG.
Right. Well, the thing was screaming right at me, and I had enough time to see the thing coming at me. So I did.
At the same time you were going through all the things we've been talking about, you had a lot going on in your personal life. Can you tell us a bit about that in the context of everything else you were going through?
Oof.
Another kind of trauma.
Another kind of trauma. You know, I wanted to, the original subtitle for the book was An Unrequited Love Story, and it was unrequited love in that my unrequited love of journalism, because I love doing the business, but the business doesn't always love me back. And it was the unrequited love of a woman to whom I was engaged at the time. And without giving away too much of the story, we were having difficulties that prior to my being injured that were then became an issue after I was injured. I'll just say that much.
Well,
it was a very difficult time to navigate, not only having my head caved in, I felt like I had my guts kicked in as well.
But, and I'm not going to reveal too much, it seems to me both of you were culpable in some way for the and responsible for the
blackout. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And not just because you were injured.
No. There were other factors along the way, but that didn't make it any easier after I'd been shot in the head. Let's just say.
As listeners probably will have figured out, your writing is at times both funny and self-deprecating. What role has humor and the ability to laugh at yourself played in your overall recovery?
Saved my life in a lot of ways. Kept my sanity intact. Something I've managed to glean from service men and women over the years. Even during the most difficult situations, I've been in the middle of firefights where it's life or death. And guys are able to maintain their cool and not lose their minds by having a particularly dark sense of humor about it. It's what can save your sanity. I had a young captain tell me once that when you see your guys are laughing, even during the worst of times, you know that they're going to be okay. It's the ones that aren't laughing that you have to worry about. And I have always had a particularly dark sense of humor, I think, but I learned, after I had been hurt and I'd lost some of that, just how valuable it was to me, in my ability to process what had happened to me and carry on with the rest of my life. I would say that sometimes it's so dark that even I'm surprised by it, and other times folks might find it off-putting. But it really was able to help me figure out what the next phase of my life was going to be, because if I'd spent all my time fretting and moaning over what had happened to me, I would never be able to get on with the rest of my life. Only being able to laugh at my ridiculous circumstance and the fact that I'd been shot in the head by something that should have sent me home in a matchbox, was I able to rationalize and accept what my future was going to hold. So it saved me.
But you also write that you were upset that despite your rather good journalistic career, most people came to know you as the guy who got shot in the eye.
Well, when you get shot in the head with a rocket that doesn't explode and something that just doesn't happen all that often. In fact, in the annals of modern warfare, I don't think anyone else has actually been shot in the side of the head with a rocket.
I'm sure hoping it never happens to me.
Right. I mean, what else are you going to be known as? I don't care how good your work is. You're going to be that guy that got shot in the side of the head. And there's a certain comedy to that as well.
Well, you've said you were reluctant to watch the video, but then you decided to write a book. How long after this experience did you begin writing this book?
Well, the book chronicles the period from, much of the book takes place from that period of when I was hurt to my return, which it takes place over the course of a year, with some parts going flashing back in time and one moving successively forward. But it took me a few years to be able to sit down and to write the thing, because I was still going back to Afghanistan a lot, and I was mulling over the idea of writing a book. I didn't know how to do it. I had never done it before. So I was daunted by the idea of it, and finally I just carved out the time to sit down, squirreled myself away into this dilapidated shack in the Appalachian Mountains, and banged it out in the winter of 2014, that first draft, which every aspiring book writer is, you know, really excited about until finally someone reads it and says, you know, holy moly, this is a dumpster fire. You need to do something about this. And so it took me a couple years to get it into a place where a publisher wanted to publish it.
Did you find writing about it was cathartic in any way?
I thought it would be. I was wrong. I thought that there would be some grand catharsis, because there was still a lot that I was lugging around from that situation. But what I learned is that much of it was I dug it all up again, and I kept going over it and working on it and polishing it and trying to get the story the way I want it to be. And I was living during that time in that moment. I'd lived. That's why I say I don't need to go back and watch that video, because I know that moment. I lived it. It'll be forever scorched onto the hard drive that is my brain. But also it's something I was contemplating for years on end in that moment and everything else that happened to me afterward, to the detriment of the life I was leading. I was not living in the present. I was only in the past, and it had some adverse effects on me, I think.
What can you tell us about Afghanistan, what you learned about Afghanistan and the Afghan people that the American public might not know? Do you think that we're getting good reports from Afghanistan?
I think there's an abundance of really good reporting coming out of Afghanistan. I think too few people are reading it. I find that I have people ask me, you know, we never see stories about Afghanistan. Why is that? And I'm thinking to myself, where are you looking? I inevitably, when someone says to me and I ask, well, what publications do you read? And they tell me, well, I don't read any publications. Okay, fine. What do you watch? And they don't watch the news either. So I don't understand how they think this is just going to be magically transmitted into their cerebellums about what it is that's going on in the world.
But Carmen, it's rarely on page one anymore. And we're talking about the longest war the United States has ever been engaged in.
I see what you mean. However, my counterpoint to that is there is no page one. My page one are the stories in which I'm interested. And the access to information is greater now than any time in history. And tomorrow, it would be even better. The fact is, there are 200 stories a day coming out of Afghanistan that are in English that anybody can read at any time who has a smartphone or a laptop and knows how to use Google. You can find out anything you want. It's not about the front page. I don't care about half the stories on the front page of the New York Times. They're not of interest to me. My front page story, if I'm going to be looking at the physical copy, might be on A23, and that's where you'll find the Afghanistan story. We have to stop thinking about our news consumption in terms of the front page. It's what we think is important. And I understand that editors and people who produce news try to put the most important stories up front or what they think the public needs to know, but at the same time, they're trying to sell newspapers. So there'll be three stories about Trump on the front page of the New York Times because they know that that's going to sell more papers. But if you are a conscientious news consumer, you have to be able to look beyond that quote-unquote front page and get to the stories that you think are important. And that's part of our responsibility as citizens.
Well, one of the stories that did make it to the front page, is at least for a little while, was that U.S. representatives are sitting down with Taliban leaders for talks about ending the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. What do you hear from people in Afghanistan about the continued U.S. presence there? Do many hope that we will leave as soon as possible?
Well, there are those who are who would like to see that, because they would prefer, at least if under the Taliban they knew what they were getting. There's some people that are like that. There are some people that are ardently pro-Taliban. They definitely want to see them come back. There are some folks that do not want them to see them come back and do not want to see U.S. forces leave, because they know that the very fragile government that they have in place will collapse and the Taliban will take over. So it's not as though the Afghan people are a monolith about, you know, their opinions about what the U.S. is doing there and why they should be there and if they should leave. Everybody's got their own take on it. Just like in the U.S., you know, some people are Trump supporters, some people are not Trump supporters, and some, you know, you can't say what do American people think about Trump. You know, same concept.
Well, nothing has been formalized. It appears that in exchange for a removal of U.S. troops, the Taliban will pledge to ensure that Afghan territory wouldn't be used by them or other Islamist militant groups to harm American interests. They won't help ISIS. Do you think that we can trust them to abide by an agreement like that?
Absolutely not. No way. Anyone who thinks that we can just wants to get the hell out of Afghanistan. And I know that's part of the Trump play. He wants to be able to say it up ahead of 2020. Hey, look, we successfully negotiated a peace deal with the Taliban. Even if that peace deal turns out to be utter garbage and leaves millions of Afghans in the lurch and subsequently subject to Taliban tyranny, he wants it on his resume.
Now, you're married now, have a young daughter. How has that changed your attitude about the type of reporting you do? Because aren't you a little concerned when you go into dangerous areas?
Yes. I've spent a lot of last year and the year before, I was covering the fighting in Iraq, particularly in Mosul.
You traveled in Iraq by motorcycle?
Yes, I did. I've done a couple of trips in Iraq by motorcycle recently, and it is something that I have to be concerned about for sure. I don't want to leave. I want my daughter to grow up with a father, and I want to be there to see her grow up. She's 2.5 now, but at the same time, something I know how to do, and it's something I want to continue doing. I'm not doing it as much, but at the moment, but I do have plans to return both to Iraq and Afghanistan in the future. So,
well,
I just have to be careful.
It is
more careful than I was last time.
I'd imagine most Americans assume that Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, they are all kind of similar. How different is Iraq from Afghanistan?
That's like saying how different is Mars from Earth?
That's pretty different.
Completely different setups in terms of the fighting, for example. You had a lot of urban combat in Iraq, house to house, room to room even. In Afghanistan, it's mostly rural fighting in the mountains and the deserts, and it's a much different fight, which makes it more difficult in some ways because the enemy is very elusive in Afghanistan. Or you feel like you always have eyes on you, but you can't see them, and that can be very difficult, both in terms of the fight and on your psychology. Iraq had a certain amount of economic success that it experienced through the 80s and 90s, and had a certain amount of prosperity, much of which was destroyed after the initial invasion in 2003, from which they're still trying to recover. The old adage in Afghanistan is, the problem with Afghanistan is it looks exactly the same after you bomb it as you did before. You would see these airstrikes come in where U.S. Planes would hit this mountaintop where they thought somebody was firing on U.S. forces, and it would create this huge explosion on the top of a mountain. And you would look at that same area 10 minutes later after the smoke had dissipated, and you would think, okay, where did they drop that ordnance? Like, where did that bomb? Where did they drop that bomb? You couldn't even tell because it's a mountainous, remote, wild country.
Reporting from war zones is obviously important for the rest of the world, although otherwise we won't know what's going on. But how clear a picture do you think a foreign journalist is able to get? Won't things be filtered through a foreign journalist's Western sensibility?
Absolutely. I've been very critical of my own reporting in that sense. Much of the reporting that I've done has been in the company of U.S. forces and their Afghan counterparts and other NATO forces, and I've never. So I would only see the fighting from that one perspective. I've never accompanied the Taliban into the mountains and saw them attack U.S. forces from the other side. So I don't have a complete picture. I think my reporting is inherently flawed from that perspective. I just tried to do the best I could with what I had by telling the stories of the men and women on the ground and what they were going through and what the challenges they faced and what that bigger picture was for the fight in Afghanistan.
So it's not possible to really get a clear picture of all sides of a conflict.
No, absolutely not, no.
You've recently started a new project called Post-Industrialist Media. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, Post-Industrial and postindustrial.com.
Post-Industrial,
right, Post-Industrial and postindustrial.com, all one word, is a look at the regions that are commonly known as the Rust Belt and the Appalachia, which we identify as an area that has had some success in reinventing itself after primarily industrial and mining industries for decades. And we're based in the Pittsburgh area, because that's where I grew up, and my partner on this project, Matt Stroud, is also a journalist based here. We are taking a deep dive, investigative look at the stories from this region, you know, the good, the bad, who's thriving, who's struggling in this new economy, in this new era for a region that is trying to reinvent itself. And Pittsburgh, in our estimation, in both the Rust Belt and Appalachia, has had the most success doing just that. This was a heavily steel and manufacturing and coal-based economy in this region, in western PA, and has now evolved into technology, banking, medicine, education. These are the now pillars that are propping up this new era in the city and in the region, and not just in the Pittsburgh area, but across this, like I said, the Rust Belt and Appalachia. However, not everyone is benefiting from all these changes. There's the old notion of the rising tide lifting all the boats has never been true, but it's particularly not so in this time and place, because you'll see communities just right down the river from downtown Pittsburgh, which are being decimated and have been for decades by the changing economy. There's joblessness is rampant, and of course, opioid abuse and other subsequent ills of a lack of employment.
So it sounds like you're at a different kind of war zone, that's all. Only in this case, maybe climate change is at the center of this war.
Yeah. Well, you know what? One of the things that I'm looking at in this post-industrial endeavor is veterans-related issues. A lot of servicemen and women come from these two regions. And then after their time in the military is up, they return to these regions. So there's a large concentration of veterans from all wars, but particularly the last two in Iraq and Afghanistan, settled into this region trying to reassimilate and figure out their lives after the fight. Some are doing well, others are not. And these are the types of stories I'm going to be taking a close look at as well.
And how do people access Post-Industrial Media?
Oh, postindustrial.com, all one word.
Okay.
Postindustrial.com.
Meanwhile, we have this book, Carmen Gentile, G-E-N-T-I-L-E, Blinded by the Taliban, a journalist's story of war, trauma, love, and loss, published by Skyhorse. It's been a great pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you very much. I really appreciated talking to you, too.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Carmen Gentile, to Todd McGovern, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Let It Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Let It Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Let It Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.